In the vast reaches of the dry, cold night, thousands of stars were constantly appearing, and their sparkling icicles, loosened at once, began to slip gradually towards the horizon. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, a short distance from where the 401 and 402 highways meet in London, Ontario, Canada. The terrestrial planets have been compared to campers, huddled around a fire. Mercury sits close enough to be scorched, while the Earth keeps warm enough to keep the water in its cup from freezing. Further out, beyond the snow line, lies the realm of the gas and the ice giants with their frigid coterie. But still further, beyond the domain of the planets, where the sun is nothing more than a bright star shedding a cold, wan light. At 1/1600th or less of the illumination of a bright, clear day on Earth, it's barely enough to see the glittering surfaces of the lonely, icy bodies that populate this vast reach. This is the kind of tableau that comes to my mind when I hear the evocative words of Albert Camus's opening quote. Still, we can perceive these worlds. One by one, over time, they have revealed themselves as they move slowly across the background of stars or shine by their own weak infrared radiation. These mysterious fellow travelers have long been suspected, but only recently have they been observed. Already, they have challenged the way we view the distant solar system, and soon we will get our first up-close look at the nearest of these bodies. Until then, astronomers, such as tonight's subject, Dr. Wesley Fraser, strive to catalog, model, and understand the origins and evolution of these icy worlds. In simplistic terms, we can classify such trans-Neptunian objects as belonging either to the Kuiper Belt, those who remain close enough to the Sun that their orbits are flattened relative to the plane of the solar system, or the Oort cloud, a vast swarm of icy objects which surrounds the solar system and stretches out to the very edge of the sun's influence. Transitioning us to Parshati Patel's interview with Dr. Fraser tonight is Solar Field's rendition of Still Alive, Razor's Edge.
Sitting down with us today.
My pleasure.
To us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let me start off by asking you, your research area is mainly in Kuiper Belt objects. So what are these objects?
Kuiper Belt objects are very much like asteroids. They're small bodies in the outer solar system that occupy a belt or something like a belt or a disk. They're, unlike the asteroids, they're very icy rather than rocky. And they're basically the remnants of planet formation, like Pluto, of course, is no longer a planet. And it's because we now know that those objects were the failed planets. They failed to grow up to be a planet. And that's what the Kuiper Belt is.
So from what I understand, they are icy. Are they easily detectable? How would you detect them?
Well, they're very far away, and so that, no, they're not very easy to detect. And this is why it was only about a decade ago that the second Kuiper Belt object was known. Of course, Pluto's been known for quite a while now, but Pluto also happens to be one of the very bright ones, and people expected it, so they knew what to look for. No one really thought too much about the existence of a belt of small bodies or icy things floating around in the outer solar system. So they're very faint. It takes large telescopes, you know, some of the largest in the world to do the science that we want to do. And even that's just scratching the surface because of how far they are, how far away they are.
Okay, so what are the size distribution and orbit like for these kinds of objects in the outer solar system?
Well, the orbits were the first thing we were able to, we being people in my field, were able to look at. When we started thinking about what a disk of asteroids or a belt of asteroids in the outer solar system like the Kuiper belt might look like, we expected a nice flat disk, you know, everything on a very thin plane on roughly the plane of the solar system. As you may or may not know, all the other planets, are, other than Pluto, of course, are on this plane. And that's essentially what we expected for the Kuiper belt objects. It turns out that some of those objects are, in fact, on this plane, but maybe only up to half or something like that. The rest of them are actually on very excited orbits. They don't occupy a plane so much as a cloud. They're just a big cloud of objects, and we now know the reason for this is because they originated in a region much closer to the solar system, sort of around where the gas giant planets are now, somewhere in there. And then because of the mean gravitational influence of the gas giants, which essentially act as bullies to smaller bodies, they have been scattered onto their current orbits. So they are excited objects. And so the ones that we see lying in the plane on this nice flat little disk or ring, we call those the cold objects because they haven't been excited very much. And then the other population are the what, you know, commonly called the hot or excited population, because we now know that they have been scattered and influenced by the gas giants. And so that was interesting because it means a lot of the stuff we see, it's almost proof that a lot of the stuff that we see in the outer solar system, in fact, came from much closer than the inner solar systems, or in the inner solar system, so we can study them with that aspect. Once we were able to see a lot of these things, when we know what we were looking for, people started measuring the size distribution. So when we were able to start, you know, pointing bigger and bigger telescopes at these things, we were able to study the size distribution. The size distribution is a harder thing to measure because you need to measure the sizes or equivalently the brightnesses, because, you know, a bigger object is brighter. So you measure the brightness of a whole whack of objects, and then you can infer the size distribution from that. It's not just measuring a few orbits, and you have to measure a whole bunch of things. But when we did that, it became very clear that the size distribution of these guys are, or of the Kuiper belt, the KBOs, are representative of a population that didn't grow for very long. So they are indicative of a very short phase of planet formation. So they were growing to become a planet for a while, just like the asteroids were, and just like presumably everything else in the outer solar, or in the solar system. But it got stopped really quickly. So they didn't evolve very far, and this is why the biggest things you see are tiny, right? Pluto is quite a small thing compared to Earth or something like this. We believe it's the scattering amongst the gas giants that shut that planet off, or shut the planet growth off. When the gas giants decided to be mean to the rest of the solar system, everyone else kind of had their, you know, their growth stopped at that point. That's what we've learned from, that was actually the subject of my thesis, was the size distribution stuff.
Okay, so yeah, so we can find a wide variety of sizes.
Yeah.
Especially in smaller ones, right?
Yeah,
okay, so what kind of compositions would we expect? I mean, I know it's going to be icy out there, but
yeah.
Still, do they have white flavors?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Compositions are a tough thing to measure because things in the Kuiper belt are faint. Even Pluto is faint, right? Like, you need a big thing. We need a big telescope to stare at Pluto. And the problem with measuring compositions, we have to get what are called spectra, where we, you know, like a prism will divide out the light of the sun. Well, we do exactly the same thing with prisms and gratings and telescopes to divide the light up coming from KBOs. And for the bright, maybe the 50 biggest, brightest things in the Kuiper belt, we can actually get reasonable spectra for. And when we observe those spectra, we see signatures of ice, so absorptions in the spectra where certain wavelengths don't come in. And so we see water ice commonly on many of these things. On the largest few, we see what are called volatile ices, like methane and ethane. These are materials that are very unstable and can just sublimate off of the surface, and it's only by virtue of gravity of the biggest things that some of this methane and ethane and whatnot has remained. For the smaller things, unfortunately, we can't get very good spectra, so all we can do is measure generic colors, right? Like this thing is red, this thing is blue. Well, it's really as simple as that. We observe in the optical and the near IR, and we get 5 or 6 different samples of color as a function of wavelength, and we can see some things that are completely neutral, like snow, water ice. That's a completely flat neutral substance until you get into the near infrared. We see some things that are very red, some of the reddest things in the solar system. So we're, you paint red on a blackboard, or on a whiteboard, that's what that looks like. We believe those are well described. The color well matches organic ices, and these organic ices are the same things that you get in the laboratory when you allow ice chemistry to occur with methane and ethane. It's sort of just a red organic gunk that's left over from some early heating chemistry. So that fits pretty well with the fact that there's methane and ethane that exist on the larger things. We know it once was on these bodies. It's just since been bled away, and all we're left with now is the red gunk. So there's all sorts of flavors of surface. They're all icy, as far as we can tell so far. We haven't been able to find minerals or rocks or anything like this yet. We know that obviously rock and stuff has to be out there, and we just haven't been able to find the signatures of it. But of the icy things, that's as far as it goes, roughly, so far. That's one of my current primary subjects of study for these things, to figure out what the heck they're made of.
Okay, so in like a big picture, what can these objects help us to understand in terms of planet formation?
Ah, great question. The goals, the main goal, maybe one or two goals, is to figure out what was in the protoplanetary disk. So, the way the solar system formed is a disk formed with a protostar or the protosun in the center, and out of the disk fell out all the planets and the asteroids and all the other planetesimals, including the Kuiper Belt objects. We are on the Earth, so we know what's in the Earth and what's on the Earth, and we know what, therefore, was roughly the composition of the protoplanetary disk at about the Earth's distance. We've sent satellites and whatnot to some of the gas giants, and we can do very similar things there. We're trying to do the same thing with the Kuiper Belt, or at least where Kuiper Belt objects came from. We know that there was some amount of ice. Obviously, there's water ice that was pretty ubiquitous. We know that there's things like methane and ethane that were in the disk as well, but we really want to know things like how much dust was there in the outer solar system, because, of course, the dust is what gives you the rock content. We also want to know ratios of other chemical species, because when we know that about our own disk, we have the end state of planet formation very well understood here, but we don't have the beginnings of our own system. We can observe early disks in the universe elsewhere in our own galaxy, and we have the beginnings there, but we can't see the end very easily. So one of the dreams all of us scientists have is to figure out what the protoplanetary disk was made of and compare that to systems forming planets now, so we can really understand the planet formation process. The other hope is that when we understand what the disk was made of, we can then tie what we see in the Kuiper Belt and their various types and compositions to where they formed within the disk itself. Because, as I said, the hot population came from, we believe it came from a region much closer than where they currently are, but we really don't know where that region was, and compositions might give us an ability to pinpoint that spot in the disk. These are the hopes and dreams and aspirations of current Kuiper Belt scientists.
Okay. From what I understand, there are also many binary Kuiper Belt objects. So would you like to elaborate more on those kind of systems?
Certainly. It was a really big surprise to find so many binaries in the Kuiper Belt. Pluto was known to be a binary roughly a decade after it was discovered. That's as far as it went. The first few large KBOs that were found back in the early 90s were not binaries, but as people stared more and more and studied these things more carefully, it became clear that there are a whole whack of binaries. Roughly about 15% of all observable Kuiper Belt objects right now are binaries, which is a really large number. The asteroid belt and other small body populations of the solar system don't have anywhere near as many binaries as the Kuiper Belt does. There appear to be two flavors, if you want to call them flavors. The small things, maybe a few hundred kilometers across and smaller, they're in very interesting equal mass binaries, in that the the secondary, the smaller of the two, isn't really that much smaller than the thing it's orbiting. They don't orbit, you know, it's not one body orbiting the other. They orbit around each other, and the center of mass is between the two. And those are pretty neat, because they are representative of how the planet has most formed. It's giving us some probe about planet formation. We don't quite have a handle on that yet, but we do know that it's very easy to disrupt these things, so we can learn about the dynamics of these things. That is not my expertise, and I can recommend a few other people for you to speak to if you haven't yet. My expertise is on, or at least growing expertise is on the other kind. Pluto does have a satellite, and it's a smaller thing, but if you look at most of the really large Kuiper Belt objects, so these are like, you know, Pluto's 2,000 kilometers across. Eris, the big brother of Pluto, is something like 100 kilometers larger. Quarwar, one of my particular objects that I study with some intensity, that's about 1,000 kilometers across. When you look in that size range, most of the big Kuiper Belt objects seem to have these tiny little speck satellites. They, much like the moon is small compared to the Earth, these things are small compared to the primaries. And so they're a very different kind of binary than the smaller members of the Kuiper Belt. They're interesting because the most favored scenario for where these small satellites have come from is this exactly the same scenario that produced the moon. So the proto-Earth was a little bit larger at some point, maybe even as much as a 50% larger, and some big mean bullet came along and smacked into the Earth and really, you know, really shook up the Earth and sprayed a lot of material off, and some of that remained as a disk which eventually coalesced into the moon. And so roughly the same thing has occurred for Pluto and Eris and Quarwar and a few of the other named Kuiper Belt objects. And so it's really interesting because it tells us there was a lot of really active collisional evolution that occurred probably at about the same time that all these bodies were lifted up and scattered to the outer solar system, because it's the hot things that appear to have the satellites.
Okay, so is that only the kind of evolution we expect, or there can be more flavors, as I say?
Well, when we first started looking at these satellites, it appeared that they were all the same in the sense that, you know, each one of the big objects suffered a collision and you produced a satellite, and the satellite, just like the Earth's moon, is on a circular orbit. Well, you produce circular orbits in exactly the same way, and so it was a nice, pretty picture that explained most of the small satellites around the big things. But the Quarwar, the object that I'm studying, its satellite, Weiwoot, Quarwar, Weiwoot, way too many vowels for a pair of names. Anyways, Weiwoot is not found on a circular orbit. That really, really messes things up for us, because, you know, with the way we believe these things formed is you produce a disk of gas and dust that, you know, forms a ring just like Saturn's rings, and unlike Saturn's rings, which remain the way they are, eventually this dust will stick back together and you produce an object on a circular orbit. But if you want to produce an eccentric orbit, you can't use a ring. Rings are always circular. And so Weiwoot's on an eccentric orbit, and we thought, well, you know, this is strange. So maybe, what could come up and create that? And we thought, well, probably tidal evolution would be a great way to go. And so we did some rough tidal evolution estimates, you know, how long would it take to evolve the eccentricity outwards? And it does turn out that Weiwoot and Quarwar are in a particular configuration that Weiwoot's eccentricity looks like it probably is increasing. On the other hand, Eris and its satellite Dysnomia, what Dysnomia is on a circular orbit, or very nearly circular orbit, they're in a configuration where the eccentricity is shrinking. So at first glance, it actually appeared like, hey, maybe this works. But unfortunately, it turns out that the evolution is way too slow. So we know that at the absolute longest it could have taken to get to where we are now is the age of the solar system, right? Mm-hmm. 4.5 billion years. You can't take longer than that because these objects didn't exist before the solar system did. And so that's the limit. When we run our tidal evolution calculations, we have to have the current state at 4.5 billion years. At the absolute latest, we don't want to actually get that far, but it turns out you need something like 200 billion years to get to our current state. So we know tides are affecting things out there, but it can't be the only thing. Most likely, and my favorite opinion is that it's not one type of collision that produce the different satellites. It's there are varied types of collisions, and there's some other evidence for that as well.
Okay, so would you like to elaborate a little bit more on how the process of tidal evolution actually works?
Well, it's just like the interactions with the moon. When the moon raises ocean waves, these are the tides people are most familiar with, and of course they're called tides because that's what sailors called them first. And it moves water around on the Earth, and the effect of that is to heat the water a little bit. So there's a transfer of energy to the water, but there's also a transfer of angular momentum. And so, the Earth spins faster than the Moon spins around the Earth. And so the net effect is a slight heating of the Earth, very, very minimal. It doesn't really account for anything, but a slight heating of the Earth and an angular momentum transfer from the Earth to the moon. So the Earth slows down a very minuscule amount every year, and the moon moves outwards a very minuscule amount every year. Eventually, we will get our system, the Earth moon, will be in what's called tidal lock, just like Pluto and its satellite Charon, in that the face of Charon always faces the face of the Pluto, and on they go, and they just circulate around each other that way. And so it's exactly the same processes that are occurring for all of these smaller things as well. There's an angular momentum exchange between the two objects because of the fact that they spin at a different rate than they orbit around each other. And so we know tides affect essentially every pair of bodies in the solar system, some much more than others. Turns out for the Quarwar and Weiwoot, it's some effect, but not the only effect.
Okay, so about this system, do we know anything about their composition?
Yeah, that's you're asking another great question. Quarwar was originally appearing to be pretty bland. It looked like every other large object in that it had some volatile ice on the surface. It had a satellite, and it appeared moderately dense. But when we looked really closely, it turned out that, we measured the position of Weiwoot on a few different occasions, and from that you can figure out what Weiwoot's orbit is, and we very clearly saw the Weiwoot's eccentricity. But what that also tells you is the mass of Quarwar itself. And we knew what Quarwar's size was, give or take, and then we figured out the mass, and from that you can figure out the bulk density. And it's, despite the fact that Quarwar's surface is icy, its interior is mainly rocky. Quarwar is much closer in density to a rock than it is ice. In fact, it's very likely the densest thing we know of in the Kuiper Belt. And so that's unusual. We know Eris's density is, it's relatively high, at the density of something like 2.4. Pluto has a density of a little bit more than 2. Haumea, another one of the large objects, density of about 2.2, something like that as well. Quarwar has a density of like 2.6 or greater. And rocks are a density of, 2.5 to 3. So it really does look a lot more like a rock than it does a block of ice, which was really shocking at the time. A lot of people didn't believe it, and I didn't believe it either, so we went off and observed it to confirm this. And so that is the reason why I think the reason why Weiwoot is on an eccentric orbit is not because of tidal evolution, but because of the collision that formed it. The reason why densities in the large objects are higher than we see for smaller things is because, you make an icy shell around a rock, as planetesimals grow, and then you hit it really hard, and you blast off a whole bunch of that ice, and you send it flinging throughout the solar system, and the net effect is to raise the overall density a bit more than you get for the other things. And that works out really well for Pluto, works out really well for Eris and Haumea. Quarwar is a bit of a challenge because you need to knock away basically most of the ice, so it's in a unique situation. You have to blast away a huge amount of its initial ice fraction to get to the density that we currently see. And so it's not unreasonable, since it requires such a crazy collision, that the satellite, which is also probably a result of this collision, is also unusual in its own sense. So it seems like the scenario that it's the same general scenario, that collisions are responsible for most of the properties of the big things we see. However, it's just Quarwar stands out as unique compared to all of the others.
From what I understand, if these satellites are due to the collision, they would probably have around the same composition as their parent.
It's probably, so that's an excellent question. Sadly, the answer is actually no. So you can imagine an icy shell around a rocky core, and then you come along and you punch that object. Most of the ice is going to go flying around, and the core can remain relatively intact. And so it's the ice that produces the satellites we see. So the satellites themselves, if this picture is true, then the satellites themselves have to be primarily icy. And as far as we can tell, that's true. I mean, the big objects are hard enough to see. The small thing, the icy things are even more of a challenge. But roughly, it appears true that they are icy. So at least the picture kind of fits. We're still working on that one, though. You've asked a very good question, and that's one of the tests of this scenario or the nice picture we've painted.
Let me ask you, what in future can we expect in terms of studies and simulations or observations for these kinds of objects?
Well, so one of the types of observations we're working on for various reasons is trying to determine sizes of Kuiper Belt objects. As I said, a bigger thing appears brighter than a smaller thing. Very technical terms. But you can also make something brighter by making it shiny, right? Ice, snow is brighter than concrete, and so if you made an object out of a rock, like the asteroids appear quite dark compared to many Kuiper Belt objects. And so the brightness is not enough to figure out the size of these things. It's actually very, very difficult to determine the size of Kuiper Belt objects, just because they're so far away, we only see them as little pinpricks of light. And so astronomers have come up with a few tricks to figure this sort of thing out, but sizes are one of the things astronomers are working very hard to determine right now, and there are a few tricks up our sleeves, and Quaoar actually is an object that the size hasn't been determined very well. There have been a few different attempts at measuring the size, including some of my own, and not everyone agrees, and this is why I say Quaoar appears to be the most dense thing. We don't actually know what its size is, and so we don't know its density very well. And so one of the projects I'm working on, especially for Quaoar, is to try what we call an occultation, where you use the background stars, and eventually Quaoar crosses a background star, and it casts a shadow on the Earth. And you literally measure the start and end times of when that shadow passes over the particular telescope you're at the time, and it's as good as dropping a ruler across that particular part of Quaoar. So those sorts of observations are being hunted by many groups now because they're excellent at determining sizes amongst other properties, shape and atmospheres and all this sort of thing. So it's extremely difficult to do, and we've been working on it for a very long time. Well, some of us have been working on it for a very long time and pretty fresh on the scene, but it seems to be working, just starting to work now. The other thing, I've painted a pretty picture about collisions in the outer solar system and whatnot, but that's all speculation on my behalf. We don't actually know for 100% certain that collisions are fully responsible. We need to test that. And so we have four or five interesting Kuiper Belt objects now that have satellites and relatively well-measured densities. So we actually have the end states of collisions, and we can go off and simulate these. So some people are working on some really exciting computer simulations to take some initial imaginary Kuiper Belt object and hit it really hard with some other small, fast-moving Kuiper Belt object and see what comes out to try to match what we see. This has been done pretty successfully for Pluto, and moderately successfully for another object, Haumea, and, well, Quaoar, I think, is the next most pressing target for this because of its unusually high density. So with those simulations in mind, if we can show this to actually be true, that the scenario of collisions, then we actually learn a lot about the early solar system and the fact that objects were zipping around all over the place, producing crazy different ranges of collisions and this sort of thing. It's a really exciting time in that. So I look forward to when those are actually done.
Okay, thank you so much for talking to us today.
It's been my pleasure.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Dr. Fraser, and he was talking about the small objects of the solar system, that is the Kuiper Belt objects. And the most interesting thing about them, they are so far away. Still, they have so much in them that can be studied and, that can help us derive a lot of things about how the planet formation or the whole formation of the planet theory occurred, or like how the whole thing went down. What are your thoughts about having such small objects teach you so much?
The solar system is a much busier place than we imagined a century ago. We were still finding new planets around that time. And now we're finding countless objects that populate the solar system. Every which place, you know, in near where the inner planets are, in the asteroid belt, and way out beyond the orbits of the planets. And we've got these, all these little things out there we really don't understand yet.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to hear Dr. Fraser talk about how this is a really evolving science, a really young science. We only really learned about, well, we only proved the existence of the Kuiper Belt in the 90s, and we're still figuring out the basics about it. And he proposed several, or he talked about several different ideas that have been proposed that they're working on proving or disproving. And it's really science in the process.
It's really interesting how you get these things that become discovered and they challenge sort of the old order and the old way of thinking about things. We went through, of course, we have to briefly mention, you know, the fate of poor Pluto, but...
Pluto deserved it.
Well, so says Mike Brown. But the same thing happened with Ceres a couple of hundred years ago. So
yeah, the largest object in the solar, in the asteroid belt, renamed from a planet to just an asteroid.
Exactly. Now, for different reasons, of course, at that time, what it was is they were running out of astrological symbols for all of the new asteroids that were being discovered. And so they finally decided to change the classification. I like to think we have a bit more of a scientific conversation this time around when it came to these trans-Neptunian objects, Kuiper Belt objects.
It's interesting that, you know, we don't know exactly how many, but there's a large number of these objects out there whose positions and orbits and dynamics are still really not well understood. That population still has to be characterized. And I guess right now the state of the art is to wait for reflected light from the sun. And these things are small and far from the sun, so of course they're very faint. But I saw an interesting proposal just a couple of years ago at a conference in Kingston, where they were talking about how you might use stellar occultation to find Kuiper Belt and Oort cloud objects, and just put a very sensitive detector and basically look for transits of Kuiper Belt objects in front of stars of known brightness. And this mission has yet to fly, but it's a nice idea anyway.
The problem is the amount of space that you have to survey simultaneously to do something like that. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, a lot of these searches out there tend to be in the infrared.
Yeah.
So I know that WISE took a look for it, but again, it's such a huge volume, and stuff that's that far out from the sun moves so slowly.
Yeah.
Because that's what we look for. In, you know, when it comes down to it, we're still Clyde Tombaugh looking and flipping between two images. We're using a computer now instead of, you know, a nice illuminated box to do it. That's how we can determine things conclusively.
Yeah, it's really hard. And the fact that these things are so faint, so slow moving, it's amazing that we found as many as we have.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if, you know, ESA has the Gaia mission coming up in the next couple of years, which should be able to detect everything down to magnitude 20. So I wonder just how many of these far out objects we're going to catalog with that.
And it's also very interesting to see how studying these kinds of objects can actually tell you about how the composition, how the evolution of these kind of objects actually came into being. Especially when he talks about the Quawar and Wayward, which is a binary system, and how there are other binary systems and how that one is so different in, you know, compared to other ones.
Yeah, the binary systems are really interesting because they tell us a lot about how these things interacted out there, especially when they were being propelled out as Neptune was migrating through the solar system. And the fact that the planets moved their orbits is, we learned about that in large part thanks to our information from the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah, talk about a dynamics laboratory. I mean, how many examples of little bodies that got scattered out there, perhaps in binary or higher numbered systems, orbiting each other in every possible way, some of them tidally locked and some of them with elliptical satellites and some of them with circular orbits. Every kind of thing out there, probably every example of every little multi-body dynamical system you're ever going to want, except we just have to find them.
And it's interesting you mentioned tidally locked, because one thing that we cannot overemphasize is that things that are this far away and this faint, like the Kuiper Belt objects, suffer the same problem that basically exoplanets suffer. We know so little about them mm-hmm. that it's very easy to go beyond the knowledge that we have. I mean, you see a certain point of light, you need to know things about it. You need to know the albedo. You need to know how simple things like how big it is. And so from, you know, a magnitude, whatever, object moving slowly across the sky, you have to be careful that you don't assume, you know, a size and a mass and a history and on and on and on. And of course, with exoplanets, we see a dip in a light curve and suddenly we are drawing geography and talking about cloudy planets and watery planets and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of those turn out to not even be planets or like a background star. It's simply a mistake.
Yeah, the imagination runs rampant. You draw vast conclusions from half-vast data.
But we will have some better data coming up very soon with the New Horizons mission.
Yeah, this is exciting.
Yeah, it's really nice we're actually sending something out there.
But of course, so we'll look at Pluto was the primary target there. I guess they're sort of frantically looking for some other object a little farther out that they can send it to afterward.
That's right, for the second encounter, and they're really doing a concerted effort to study Pluto, and that's why in the last couple of years we've found a couple more satellites of this thing.
Yeah.
One just very recently.
Yeah, just a week or two ago they found this fifth body.
Mm-hmm. We're definitely running out of things in Hades to name out there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's very interesting how, other than ice, we can expect so many different, these bodies formed of so many different composition, like methane, ethane, things he was talking about. And just being here on Earth, looking for objects so far and determining its composition, that's long shot hard work. it's not easy to be looking at a dark object and, assuming the albedo and assuming finding out the density and what kind of material it's made of and comparing it with the other Kuiper Belt objects that are already known.
But the rewards from this process are huge because these objects were scattered out to the Kuiper Belt from potentially many different places within the solar system. So we can learn all sorts of interesting things about the early stages of the solar system just by looking at this one population of objects.
Yeah, that have just been sitting out there in the cold, barely feeling the warmth of the sun for a few billions of years, unvisited, untouched.
Yeah, it's a pristine population, a remainder.
Yeah, sort of in this silent loneliness out there.
But from what their composition is, you can tell where they've been mm-hmm. in the past. You have these ideas of snow lines for different compounds.
Yeah.
You go out past you go out past the Mars system and you get ice stable on the surface. You go out further, you start to run into things like ammonia and methane and carbon dioxide on the surface in the Saturnian system. Even further out at Neptune, you get solid nitrogen ice.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can use these things as tracers as to exactly where these things have been.
Sounds like a good place to fuel up on volatiles if you were leaving the solar system.
You never know. 100 years from now.
Yeah.
Early exploration.
The fuel station.
That's right. Well, no one else seems to be using it. But, whatever's out there, whether it be volatiles or some of these objects appear to be very dense, we have probably a tremendous number, an unknown number of these tiny little worlds out there in this cold, distant place where they're just at the edge of what we can see, and there's a lot still to be learned about the present and the past of the solar system. And a lot to be found from looking from a distance, and if we ever manage to go look at them close, I think we'll find new and broader mysteries that we can't even imagine when we get to see these in detail.
Yeah, and this is all going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and John Moores. Our editors were Parshati Patel, John Moores, and Michael Forrester. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.